was going through here that had been at least a tornado warning previously, but I don't think we're, I think it's dying down by now.
So if we see your gear start swirling around behind you, we know that the tornado's hit.
Yes.
Well, you're sending it to us. We'd appreciate not getting it.
Yep. So, well, let's go ahead and start. This is the March 16th, 2021, session of Tangerine SDR and Hamsai Technical Session. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on two projects. One is I have made some progress on the, I did have a meeting with Scotty and Tom, and we talked about some things, but basically, I have made progress on my simulator for programming simulator, and I have bits and pieces of the protocol, but this is pre-Bill's protocol, and I think I got it worked out, and I got it worked out in a way that the key things are variables. So if you don't like what I propose, we can change them. I did that, and then I'm also working on a Tapper project, just by the way, with which has to do with the Whisper transmitters that run on Raspberry Pis, and we're trying to. There are a few issues with running those on Raspberry Pi 4s, so we're working through those. We have clues, but the solutions haven't been completely implemented. So that's it for me.
Hey Dave, a quick comment. We actually got that board to work on a Raspberry Pi Zero, if that helps you any.
I know it'll work on a zero. The biggest problem is the code that's supposed to work on a Raspberry Pi 4 has some copy errors. The C file and the H file don't match. And I first tried one, converting one way for the declarations of the file names, and then I ran into some other errors. So I'm going to try it the other way. But I wish I could find the original code that it all came from. So I'm doing that, and I'm working on, we're also working on the shutdown procedure, which Dave Witten has helped me a little bit with. So that's that. And next on the list is Nathaniel, W2NAF, and I bet he's been working on a meeting.
Thank you very much, Dave. Yes, I've been very busy working on the Hamsai workshop. I think we're almost there. I have a few more details to take care of. So tomorrow is going to be my detailed day for working on that. But I think the posters, the eye posters are in place. I think the oral presenters know what they need to do. The schedule is up on the list. We had a good practice session this weekend. I've got my students. I see Veronica's on here. She's been working on her poster. I think things are coming along quite nicely. So I'm really looking forward to it. W2NAF back to net.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dave. Good evening to you. Good evening to the net. spent some time working on preparing a demo for the Hamsai conference, and wasted some time because I thought, well, let's see if I can make a nicer demo if I have the program that's running the whole thing, running on a machine that I can where Zoom can run on, because Zoom won't run on a Raspberry Pi ARM architecture. Certainly, I mean, you try and get that to run with all that other stuff, with all that signal processing stuff. The last time I tried, I couldn't even find something that would even run at all. They didn't have a version available, but I'm not anyway. So finally, after burning several days on that, I kicked that out, and I'm just going to have to aim a camera at the screen. And we tested that over the weekend, and it's okay. Other than that, did a little work on the grape. got it to where it will, upon boot up, will automatically get the GPS to sync to get the time and start the new radio and start copying data into digital RF. So that is now on the grape for the version 2 of the software. So presumably we might be able to use that for the Antarctica project. So anyway, back to Ned.
Fine business. Next on the list, we have another bill, N8ET. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really haven't been doing anything. I've been meaning to come to these meetings to find out what's going on for a month or so when something has always come up. And tonight I finally remembered and had the time all at the same time. So I'm just here tonight to listen and see what's going on, and we'll see you all this weekend.
Well, very good, Bill. Glad you made it. Next on the list, we have Dan, N4XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, thank you, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Haven't really done much the last week. I've been busy, but haven't accomplished much. That's a better way to put it. So I do have one thing, I guess, that I don't think I mentioned before. I created a repository just for Tangerine SDR scripts on my GitHub site. So if you want to go there, it's under my call sign, N4XWE, and I think I have probably about 15 or 20 scripts there these days. So if you're looking for something to run software or to compile software on a ARM processor of some sort, it's a good source of script information for that. And I guess as an add-on, it's possible, even if you're compiling from your desktop with the command line, to kind of use the scripts as a reference. They're well commented, and all you have to do is copy and paste commands. So back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Dan. I think that'll be helpful. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Nothing to discuss. Really, back over to you.
Well, fine business, and keep your head down. Next on the list is Dev. Go ahead, Dev.
That's me.
Yes.
Good evening, everyone. So we are hale and hearty in a very lively spirit here in Scranton, preparing for the HAMSAI conference workshop. And I'm preparing for my paper presentation. So I'll be preparing on irregularities in the mid-latitude ionosphere. Over the weekend, go through a lot of literature. And as always, I came back very confused. So thank you.
Well, very good. Next on the list, we have Greg, VA3CBN. Go ahead.
Thanks, Dave. I'm still a bit exhausted from helping Eric on the weekend. That was really something. And I'm looking forward to this weekend's workshop and listening to all the good speakers. Back to Ned.
Fine business, and hopefully you'll recover. next on the list, we have Homan, KD2MCR. Go ahead, Homan.
Hello, good evening, everyone. Three things. Likewise, I've been working on the HAMSAI workshop presentation where I'm responsible for giving a talk about the magnetometer project for science best aspect. So I'm trying to look at data sets that we obtained from JennyJump in combination with the data set that Jule provided. So I'm working on it, and I'm really looking forward to seeing people for HAMSAI project. The second one is I've been working on the magnetometer in my lab just to see how it performs in general in collaboration with Jules and Dave. I still need to repeat the experiment because it wasn't really going well, or maybe my lab is full of noise. So I'm trying to compare data with Jules, who provided a similar data set. And by just looking at the data set that Joe provided that he performed inside his lab, the performance was very satisfactory. I'm very glad to see that such a low-cost magnetometer was performing very decently. So I'm very happy to see that. And I really appreciate Jules and Dave's effort in pushing forward. I apologize for Dave and Jules for not responding that quickly, because sometimes I'm swamped by emails as usual. And third one is with the discussion with Jules and Dave, we're trying to come up with, this is actually based on the conversation that I had with Nathaniel, that maybe we can come up with maybe slightly better version of a magnetometer than maybe the one that we are working on right now, because it is satisfactory. But maybe for some serious scientists, we really want to provide like better science data set. Maybe we can prepare for slightly better magnetometer. So Jules, Dave, and I are working on, I guess Dave Larson is also involved in that, trying to figure out what other options we could have. So we have a couple of options or candidate products that we can think of in the price range of say $500 or $600-ish, hoping that some serious scientists wouldn't mind spending extra dollars for slightly better magnetometer. I mean, not slightly, probably much better for slightly more dollars. So that's something that we are trying to figure out. But otherwise, the originally proposed magnetometer, we are working on it, and so far, so good. I'm very happy to see the progress and the level of performance. Back to Ned. Thank you.
Very good. Yes, I've been watching the traffic, and it's been quite a bit of activity among this group that he mentioned. Next on the list, we have James, KG4DSG. Go ahead, James.
Got me now.
Yes.
Got nothing new here. I'm just listening in and trying to keep up with everybody. That back to that.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Jim, K4BSE. Go ahead, Jim. I don't know if Jim's there. Well, next after Jim.
Are you hearing me now?
Now we are. Yep.
Okay. Sorry, I forgot to press the space bar to turn my mic on. I've been continuing to work on this spreadsheet I've developed, still developing on the 5, 10, 15 megahertz signals and what they might sound like at the South Pole, and found quite a few that could probably be putting in roughly the same order of magnitude signal level down there, depending on propagation. And I've got some several questions to ask on that. I think that was probably better for the Thursday morning meeting than for this meeting, though. That's about it. Thanks.
Well, thanks a lot. And next on the list, we have Jonathan Rizzo, KC3EEY. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. I was having some back and forth discussion with Tom, Scotty, Dave, and also Phil, about importing VLF RX tool streams into digital RF and understanding more about exactly how the personal space weather station database will work. But I have some questions. Maybe this would be for a general discussion, but the one thing that I wanted to know is the plan to continuously feed data from all these deployed receivers into the database, or is it going to be when it's requested or some sort of event only type thing, like maybe whisper events or things like that? And then with that, what would be the plan for the VLF data? Would we want continuous streams into a repository or just events and also lightning location? Is that going to be a system that we're going to have live with these VLF receivers? So those are the questions that I had, just to kind of understand what the end goal is here. Back to the net.
Well, fine business. And if somebody wants to answer your question, I think they'll be ready to. We might just wait till the... Do you want to answer now?
I can talk a little bit about it now, and then I can go into it more later.
Okay.
But the brief answer, Jonathan, is we don't have the exact knowledge of what data collection modes we're going to be running just yet and how we're going to do it. I envision that there will be a coordinated data collection mode that for any station that's participating as a full personal space weather station node, they would take directions from central command and they would send the data to wherever it's going. What that mode consists of exactly is yet to be decided. How often, say, we do chirp soundings, how often we do VLF receiving, how much data we can collect, that's all going to be a function of what the particular science question we're asking at the time is, as well as the capabilities of the particular single board computer it's running on, how many things we can run simultaneously, plus how much bandwidth the available user has. So all of those things need to come into consideration. I'd also say that for people who maybe are VLF enthusiasts and want to say, look, I don't want to be a part of the main, you know, program, you know, this is supposed to be something that an individual can buy and can also do what they want with. So if they decide that I want to run this as a VLF only type of node, they should have the ability to do that and then send the data to where they want to. I think we'll be working on addressing that as time goes on. We can talk about that more in the open discussion.
Sounds good. And we'll finish the list and we can have more discussion later. Next on the list is Jules K2KGJ. And Jules, you've been busy this week.
Yes, good evening, Dave and the net. As you know, Dave, by the emails, we've had a fair amount of email activity this week.
Yes.
But what I've been doing is essentially working on improvement of resolution of the RM3100 by fully utilizing its cycle count and in onboard averaging capability to produce the best signal to noise ratio we can get for one sample per second rate. I've also done some backyard testing with a Helmholtz pair and a known field level square wave drive to try to determine again what the minimum resolution was with the new configuration, and been trading that information back and forth, as you know, with Human and with Dave Witten as well. So the good news is that the potential candidate that Human and Nathaniel had looked at previously in regard to a Fluxgate NAG is actually quite compatible with our present setup. We could use, without much modification at all, the existing local board, use the Cat5 cable, add a very low power 18-bit or 16-bit three-channel AD-to-D converter at the remote end, along with the present temperature sensor, along with the present 9815 I2C extenders, and integrate this particular magnetometer with that system and do some trials. So again, the good news is it's not going to be a heavy lift to try that alternate sensor out. Back to Ned.
So quick question. So the remote board has ADC built in already?
That is correct.
Okay.
And it's an I2C ADC, very low power, actually only consumes about a milliamp.
What's the bit number, bit resolution?
There are two of them possible. One is an 18-bit, the other is a 16-bit. You can actually, 16-bit gives us a resolution that is below the peak to, or below, yeah, below the RMS, no, below the peak to peak, excuse me, noise of the candidate sensor.
Okay, good. Good to hear.
Well, and fine business. Who is that? Was that Dave?
This is David McGaw. Yeah. What sensor are you looking at?
Hyoman, you want to mention that?
Yeah, it's a Steffenmayer Fluxgate. It's low cost magnetometer, which costs about, I don't know, like $300, $400. I think it is originally made in Germany, but I think I believe that there's actually a US vendor who carries that product. So I remember I purchased that through a US vendor, but I think it is originally made in Germany.
Yeah, and there are actually two versions. There's one that is a triaxial and one package. That's a little more expensive one, but it looks like there's a second option, which are three single axis magnetometers. They appear to have the same specs in terms of noise and sensitivity, same power supply voltage and so on, which can easily be integrated. And that's about half the cost of the triaxial unit. But there again, and you know, it'll be a few $100.
Yeah, but then I think you have to build some kind of packaging, I think.
Yeah, that's correct. You'd have to do the packaging on the three. Yeah. But the, mm-hmm. but it, either one of them would easily fit into a PVC pipe for underground installation.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm particularly interested because I've used the Bartle, what is it?
Bartington?
Bartington. Yeah, I keep mixing that up with Bartolini, which is a guitar pickup. Bartington... we've flown that on rockets and balloons, but that's considerably more expensive. I'll be interested to see the resolution of these.
Interestingly, I don't know how, but the sales manager or whomever that is at Bartington found our Hemsight workshop presentation. And actually he reached out to me specifically saying that, oh, we have this and this in product. And if you're interested in, you know, please use this and stuff. And he's the one who actually gave me a specific information about a product that they are actually developing right now. The product information has not been released yet on the website, but he sent me some spec sheets and stuff, which is pretty comparable to any science grade magnetometer, but for much lower cost. But it's such, I think that's more expensive than Steffenmayer magnetometer that I just mentioned, but I don't know. It's a Bartington, you know, it's bigger company. So probably their packaging should be much fancier. He's supposed to come back to me with more detailed information after the sales department decide, you know, how much they're going to sell. So yeah, that's where we are right now. That's how I got to know about this new product that he just mentioned. So.
Oh, very interesting. Well, we'll talk about that some more later.
So, David, would you go ahead and I seem to have skipped over you. I'm not, or you were a little late. Go ahead.
Well, I was late. Hello, everyone from Chincoteague, Vermont, Virginia. I'm at Wallops for the next week or so doing integration on a sounding rocket, which is a VLF experiment. So I'm particularly interested in all of these. We also fly magnetometers on these guys. So that's what I've been doing this week. I'd hoped to get to the FPGA interface question, but just haven't had time. But I'll be interested to see if we've made any progress with that. Back to Nat.
Fine business. And next on the list is Con Tran. Go ahead.
Hello, all. Well, I'm still learning radio. Played around with GNU radio a bit. That was pretty cool. I really like that. And the big project I'm working on now, it's I'm going on a road trip in like a couple of weeks, and I'm building I'm configuring a mobile SDR system on my Jetson TX1. So that's it. Back to Matt.
Very good. And next on the list is John KJ6IBP. Go ahead, John.
At first I planned to do mostly listening and learning. I was at the last meeting. That stuff is a little beyond my programming training. I can't really help there. But in the future, I plan to set up equipment and share data.
Well, that's good. Welcome. And we'll have plenty of opportunities at all levels, so don't worry. So next on the list, we have Michael, AAAK. Go ahead, Michael. Okay. And next after that, we have KG6MKI, Just Monitoring. And then we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Yeah, this week has been spent either trying to recover from my awful cold or working on the clock module and the data engine. We had a couple new revs. And maybe in the general session, I can show the placement. We're pretty close to a final placement on the clock module. And it ends up about 40 millimeters square. So pretty small little guy, about yay big. And let's see. Yeah, getting psyched up for the ham conference. Was looking to help out on the ham expo this weekend. Was a little disappointed I didn't get to help out because it sounded like it'd be a very cool setup. So sorry to miss out on that. But other than that, I think that's it for this week. Back to you, Dave.
Okay. And next on the list is Tom, N5EG, not the last this tonight.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Been a busy week on email. Talked with Dave and a few others on the protocol and programming. I think we have some clarity there now that maybe was missing before. So made some good progress there. We had a bunch of emails on the BLF receiver tools, and I think we got a couple issues out, and we still had some things to talk about. And then Scotty and I worked through the receiver interface to the FPGA, and I think we have an agreement there on what we probably need to do. So just a lot of email, but I think it was productive. So back to the group.
Yes. Well, and the last on the list is Veronica, KD2. H-U-U-H-N, sorry.
All good. Hello, everyone. I've mostly just been working on my poster and meeting with Dr. Frisell and Bill Lyles and Dev. That's about it.
Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
And I think that brings us to the end of the list, unless somebody's was missed. I think I got everybody. We have 21 participants tonight. So we're open for general discussion.
Great. If you'd like, I can talk a little bit more about the data.
I would go ahead. Ideas. Yes.
Yeah. So as I said, what I was thinking is that right now we're still in this phase where we're building the hardware, and Bill is very busy developing the different tools that we can run on this thing. But there's going to come a time where we're not able to run everything simultaneously because of computational limits and because of bandwidth limits, and we're going to have to make decisions. So I think what we're going to need to do is we're going to want to come up with some sort of a common mode that, if nothing else is going on, this is the mode that the Tangerine will run in if it is acting as a personal space weather station. And that common mode might be a blend of different things. For instance, we might have it listen for an ionogram, every 2 minutes. We might have it consistently monitoring WWV on certain frequencies. We might have it also consistently monitoring FT8 or Whisper, because we really want to monitor that the HF ham radio propagation, not only for the science project, but also for the benefit of the amateur radio operator. During certain times, we might come up with some modes where we have a campaign. So we might have, Christina might want to run a festival frequency campaign, and she might want to have everything running in the same mode so that the tangerines match what the grapes are doing. And then hopefully we can press the switch, and then all the tangerines will just focus on doing the WWV monitoring mode for that time. Now, exactly what, and then it would return back to normal. You might also have a case where we could do what's called a triggered mode, where you see something like the KP index skyrocket, or we sense a solar flare and we have it do a special high time resolution mode where maybe it's taking more oblique ionograms than usual. I don't know exactly what this is going to look like yet, but it's going to be some blend of these different things. Similarly with the VLF, when we're getting closer to the point of we actually have something working and we're starting to collect data, then I think we want to have some of the different scientists and community members get together and say, okay, what are the things that we want to do? What is this thing capable of in terms of compute resources, in terms of bandwidth that people are going to have? What can we run? And I think we'll start coming up with a common mode, and there will be some debate about that. So that's the general thought for the personal space weather station mode.
Nathaniel, I could kick in a little short discussion of what we've got working already, if that would help.
Sure, that'd be great.
What we have running on the local host already, using a simulator as a back end instead of the data engine while waiting for that for hardware, we have it already set up to where it can run in several modes. Number one is a ring buffer, where it's configurable to the size of the ring buffer. You can configure it to take up only so many gigabytes of space, and it just erases the oldest stuff. The idea there is that it would run continuously, but it would check in with the host every few minutes as in a heartbeat. And if when I say the central host, that's a central command system at University of Alabama. If the super user, the science super user, had said, "Oh, we want the last hour's worth of data because it was a solar flare or whatever," when it checks in with a heartbeat, it would get the command to do an upload, and which would give it the bookends of the date times it wants to upload data. That already works. Another mode of operation is something we call Snapshotter, where that can run at the same time as the ring buffer mechanism. And what that does is every 110 seconds or so, it does a high resolution FFT of the spectrum. And then that is saved as a CSV file. And then you've got your choice as to what you do with that. So you can take a look at the different spectrum grams as quickly as we can save them. We have the ability to collect FT8 and whisper data. And today we're decoding those. And then we're uploading spots to PSK Reporter and WhisperNet respectively. Although we're talking about, we might work with Rob Robinette on interfacing with his system. Although his current system is very oriented towards the, one of those small Kiwi receivers or something. So we'll have to reach an accommodation on that. You can also run, there's several different kinds of modes, which I call the fire hose mode. If you have your tangerine on a local area network that has a very high speed, very high capacity server on it, we would do what we call local fire hose, where the local host basically tells the data engine, okay, here is the address of the server you're going to send everything to. And it just vomits the entire spectrum on. And, you know, it's going to take gigabits per second to do that, but we have the ability to do that if somebody wants that. And another one is what I call remote fire hose mode. And that is basically continuously uploading up to the central server at UA spectrum data. And you have the opportunity to control the amount of bandwidth that it consumes. Typically, to get spectrum data where we're looking at Doppler information, typically you want something like around 8 kilohertz of bandwidth around each thing you want to monitor. So 5 channels of WWV, and you don't need those all the time because some of those stations you don't hear at night or during the day. So anyway, we may have to have some kind of a scheduling thing on that so we don't overload the central host. But anyway, so we have a number of things already lined out and, in fact, already working. I'm sure that we're going to add more and maybe find out some of the stuff we've done so far. It wasn't really such a great idea, so we'll do something else. But that's what we have so far as a first first out of the gate. And bear in mind now, this is version one of this thing. We're trying to design this thing so that you can do all kinds of weird stuff with it, like put multiple data engines out there and multiple local hosts and share them. But for phase one, in order to actually get something working for the NSF, we've selected what we think is an achievable package of scope for the functionality. So that's my brain dump on that.
I would like to chime in that Bill has written a wonderful little article for the Tapper PSR describing a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, that is basically, I know there's been a lot of discussion in forums on how to get IQ data off your Flex radio, and there's never really been a cogent explanation on how to do that, and that basically that's what I wrote was an article on. It's basically how I did the simulator for the data engine for this project.
And it's not available yet, but it will be in the next sometime week or so. I don't know if Scotty knows, but I have seen a proof of it and been able to read it. It was quite good, Bill.
Thank you.
I'll offer that when in our AM Doppler system, we actually do a double FFT. We bring out each of the, in our case, we bring out each of the AM channels at a high sample rate. But then since we're only interested in the Doppler information on the carrier, we narrow that way down to just a couple of hertz or so. And the data rate goes way down when you do that.
Yeah, well, we can do that, although I must say that we had a lot of discussions with Nathaniel about that. And right now our thinking is that there's so much information. If you take a look at what happens at some of those, when you look at what the Doppler actually does, there's all kinds of interesting features. It's all kind of structure to it. It's not just, the frequency simply goes here and then goes there. No, there's all kind of interesting stuff that goes on.
I know, well aware of that. But the the amount of spread is limited, and we currently do it in the Raspberry Pi. But if you can do it in the FPGA, that would be even better. Maybe we can get it in there.
That's above my pay grade to decide that.
Well, that is that we left the format open ended enough that we could add that format, that very narrowband format, as a future stream if we wanted to do that.
Right. Just pointing out that it can be done and is being done, and it doesn't take a whole lot of computer power. So,
but like Bill was saying, we're focusing on the first set of features so that we can get something out the door that works, but not restrict us to being only 48 kilohertz or wider.
Right. And I know the K data rate gets the entirety of the WWV modulation, which may be useful.
Yeah, we were thinking that was useful for some disambiguation to make sure you're seeing WWV and not WWVH. That was one of the reasons we're doing that. We're also, I know Steve Serwin has also been looking at what things you might be able to, what information you might be able to get out of the sidebands additionally from just the carrier. The other thing I wanted to say about the data or the control system management, like what the experiments would be, I had a few other ideas on how we might manage this. One idea is to look at the SuperDARN scheduling system as a model. So the SuperDARN radars, there's about 30 of them around the world, and they're not all run by the same people. They're each funded by different countries, and they're run by different principal investigators, and yet they have a common mode agreement where they agree for so many hours a month, they run in a common mode. And then for so many hours a month, the individual investigators are allowed to choose which mode they want the radar to run in. And so in doing so, they've come up with a system where they are able to have the whole system work together as a network, but still give some flexibility in terms of individual investigators, what their curiosity is. That was one thought I had. Another thought was to run it, the incoherent scatter radars like Millstone Hill that Phil Erickson runs, they have a world day program where what people can do is they can write a proposal to say, I'm interested in running this experiment on all of the radars at the same time. And then there's a committee that reviews them and then grants that time. So maybe once a year or on a rolling basis, we could take experiment requests from people and potentially plan them out to do longer campaigns. This is also similar to how people would get time on, say, the Hubble Space Telescope. People would apply for a particular experiment, and if the committee, you know, thinks it's a good experiment, and if there is a time to run it on the system, it would run that way. So there's a lot of different ways to run it, and then the people who are also running it, they would have could have a certain amount of discretionary time to figure out how to run the network.
I have a question for Bill. How much of the SatNOG scheduling information did you hang on to?
You mean how much of the code?
You were using SatNOGs as an example for the prototypes of this, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically what we wound up doing was just taking their lead and basing the thing on Django and MariaDB.
Okay.
As far as the scheduling, we don't have a solution for that yet. I mean, scheduling right now, it's dirt crude. I mean, all we're going to do for phase one is give a couple of science super users the ability to request a download from the ring buffer and do a couple of other simple things. What we do in the future is, I guess it's going to boil down to what we need to do to support the science.
Yes, I was just aware that they'd work quite a bit on their scheduling because they're following satellites.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's a more restricted problem than what we have. But we may be able to take clues from their software as ideas of how to create a database of times available and requests.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I don't know if that would be within, it wouldn't be within phase one scope, but you know, if this thing is successful as what it's shaping out to be, it's entirely possible an NSF would be interested in doing follow-on projects after this first phase. That's what we hope for.
Yep.
Well, that explains quite a bit. Thank you, everybody, for giving me a better idea of what's going on. I would like to offer that Vela Forex Tools has a lot of utilities available right now that can basically decimate data. So I would like to make the argument that captured Whistlers and captured Chorus is something that would be useful to have on a database. Also, lightning location. Each VLF receiver or Tangerine SDR can upload through rsync or LFTP CSV files of time of group arrival data, and using that and some location information, another utility can spit out latitude and longitude values from that time of group arrival data in a CSV format. And then there isn't such a tool, but there's you could do some sort of visualization tool like Worldwide Lightning Location Network or Blitzertung that can create live maps of lightning data. And this is all low bandwidth data that I would make an argument that can be constantly uploaded to the database. Over time, of course, it'll add up. But I think that these would be valuable things to have, at least to start out. So That was one of the things that I was concerned about. I was trying to understand what the parallels would be with the HF data. Now I have a better understanding, and it seems like a lot of the limitations tend to be with the fact that the bandwidth is that the data bandwidth is very high, and you can't have all these receivers uploading gigabits of bandwidth constantly. So since the VLF data is much smaller bandwidth, at least with the vents and Lightning location data, you could probably have that being uploaded all the time. That would be like normal mode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, one of the things that we're designing for is that we're anticipating that a number of users are going to have simple DSL internet. And a lot of people feel lucky if they get 5 megabit bandwidth on there that's for download. Upload tends to be more like about 700, 800 kilobit. And that doesn't work well for uploading any significant amount of data. Now, having said that, we're employing some tricks. We found a way to do quite a bit of compression on the data within digital RF. That's a built-in feature. And a number of things like that. So there's kind of a balancing act there. But of course, as time goes on, when everybody starts getting connected up to Starlink, why then the sky's the limit.
Yeah, and I think what Jonathan is saying, Jonathan. So first of all, I want to point out, I very much appreciate all of your input because you absolutely have shaped a lot of the directions that we're going here. Because if it weren't for you, we wouldn't have a VLF board coming up, and you know, you've sparked off a lot of good discussion about VLFRX tools, which I think was well received on the list. And I do believe that, you know, having a diverse set of low bandwidth constant monitoring modes makes a lot of sense for the personal space weather station. Because if we can get information back from the magnetometer, from the VLF, you know, our WWV monitoring mode is a low bandwidth mode. I think that is very valuable information that we could do a lot with for just routine monitoring of the space weather environment. So I think those are excellent suggestions. And I definitely think you should continue to advocate and give us those ideas because I think they'll be well received.
Yeah, I thank you. Yeah, I feel that the capability of adding VLF receivers, especially triple axis reception, and having a global network of them and tools to decimate and understand the data. If I was a VLF scientist, I would want something like this, and at least to have a open database. You could probably have this public since it's such low bandwidth. You could have Whistler events and chorus, Lightning location. You could do plots of amplitude and phase of VLF receivers. SIT events. A lot of what the people on the VLF groups that I'm a part of is they monitor the phase and amplitude of VLF transmitters for SIDs, and that has been a lot of posts that I've seen, and also amateur work in VLF, the Dreamers band and lower frequencies. If we have a network of VLF receivers, we could actually understand propagation for people who want to do QSOs. We could do EBNOT modes, the mode that Paul came up with to transmit characters. We could do carrier mode and amateur VLF can come alive when you have a network of VLF receivers out there. and it could be a lot more fun, and you'd have a lot more people doing VLF transmissions, because now they know that there's going to be someone on the other end listening in. At least maybe they're sleeping, but that data will be recorded on the database. So that's why that I wanted to mention the amateur VLF aspect as well with this.
Now you're talking sub 100 kilohertz?
Yeah. Initially, many people started out with around 8.7 kilohertz. And there have been experiments at 5 kilohertz. And lately, there has been some around 260K. Initially, it was 8.7, but they're starting to experiment a lot more. And they're and when they do character transmissions, they want to see how many characters that they could transmit and if it can be decoded.
And here I thought it was just tinnitus.
I would like to break in here and mention Gus N6UQ has joined us, and also Joe W7LUX, just for the record of attendance.
Good evening.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So you ready for the clock module progress here?
I would say go ahead.
Okay, let's see if this will actually work. So this is the second pass, not so preliminary drawing, assembly drawing. This is the top level, top layer, and the three SMAs along the side. And maybe I can start out better by looking. There's the sizes right there. So you can see it's pretty small. And this is the high performance GPS U1 here over on the right, which is the dual band. It's the ZF9T from uBlox. And then directly under it on the back is the footprint for the Neo ones, the more inexpensive ones. And so you would actually solder either this down or the one on the back side, one or the other. You wouldn't solder both of them down. Then the TCXO is Y1 right here, and it feeds the transformer and then the jitter reducing clocking part, and then the synthesizer, which is U4. And then we've got 10 differential pairs that come off of U4 down to the connector down here. And the SMAs are for one pulse per second, 10 megahertz out, and the middle one is for the remote GPS antenna. It's an active antenna. We actually have a bias T built on the board so we can supply power to the GPS antenna. And what else do we have that's of note? This up here, this J11 is a UFL connector. UFL? Yes, a UFL connector that allows you to, if you want to change a couple of resistors, you can actually feed in your own TCXO or oven controlled oscillator or whatever reference oscillator you want that will be fed into the synthesizer eventually through all the normal regular chain of processing. And then, let's see, I think I have the...
Scotty, does that jack switch, or how do you disable the onboard?
You have to change resistors to do that.
Yeah, rather have some kind of switch or jumper.
Yeah, you know, that's a good idea. I'll look at that, because it seems to me that I did a design before that had a non-stub switched UFL that you could just plug in and it would switch the source.
Right.
So let me look at that. I think it's worth investigating. Otherwise, you do have to change the resistors, because we really want to prevent stubs in that line.
No, of course, but it would be nice to be able to switch it in, just plug it in, and at most flip a jumper, not go in and with a soldering iron.
Could you see this right here? I don't know if you can see this. This is two 0402 resistors that are laying over the top of each other.
Yeah, I know how that works.
Yeah, so you'd put this resistor in for J11. And you take that out and put this resistor in for Y1, and then that picks the clock with basically no stubs at all.
Yeah, I don't know that I would recommend it, but I know that at least the older cell phones had a switching jack for an external antenna.
Yeah, but I think there is one that you can get, so I'll look that up.
That was a Motorola radio.
Because that would be useful. Also, we eliminate two resistors, which is useful. Anyway, the backside is here. So you can see the thing is pretty well full. I mean, it's these are end launch connectors, by the way. So these will be grounds, and then the pin will be over here on the other side. The center pin will be the active output or input. And so this is the smaller GPS, the Neo version from uBlox, the real-time clock battery backup. And then most of this here is just bypass caps and bulk capacitance, because on the outputs of the synthesizer chip, they want 470 microfarad on each output. Well, 470 microfarad are big capacitors. So these barely fit on the backside. We're going to have to make sure that there's clearance on the data engine for these parts around the synthesizer chip. So that's what the CAD guy's working on now. We wanted to get this nailed down pretty well where it's going to be. And then we can place it over the CAD. He's got a CAD drawing on. He'll place it over the data engine. And we have a CAD drawing for the data engine. And we'll see if there's any mechanical interference and move parts around appropriately to make sure there aren't any interference issues. This GPS is only 2 millimeters high. We have 4.11 millimeters in between the boards when they're placed and in locked down. So you can see the battery, I think, is 2.5 millimeters, but that really only leaves space on the data engine for things like bypass caps and things. There's a few ICs that are only a millimeter high or less, but a lot of them are higher than that, which so you can't stack them then, which is unfortunate. And here is a rat's nest version of the top x-ray view. So you can see these are color-coded. So the olive color here is ground. The pink here, the hot pink, is differential pairs. And the GPS, this is the GPS antenna, comes in here and runs straight across here to the two GPS antenna pins, which are right adjacent to each other. So this is pretty critical because this is at 1.5 gigahertz. So even microscopic stub lengths are not good to have on that line. So we tried to arrange it so that the antenna pins are as close to each other as possible. And again, you'll have one or the other of these. So it won't be a stub with any load on it, but it will be a stub off of the line. And I think that's about it for that. It's pretty much nailed down. A routing guy, our PCB guy, thinks he can route this. So be very dense, and it's going to be a 6-layer board is what he's proposing.
So Scotty, the the powered antennas, is that standard? The powered GPS antennas, are those a standard thing where you can just grab up whatever power GPS antenna you're using for something else and use it in this?
Pretty much it's standard if you get a modern GPS antenna. And I think John said every one of the dual frequency antennas he's looked at uses 3.3 volts, which is what we supply. And we have a current limit circuit and an ESD protection circuit on the output here. However, that said, we have a header, which I believe is this header right up here, that will allow you to feed in external GPS antenna power for antennas that are not, are older ones or not standard ones.
Yeah, there's a very standard timing GPS antenna, multiple manufacturers, at least multiple brands, that is 5 volt only. I've made the mistake of powering it with 3.3 and it doesn't work very well. So we do need to have the capability of supplying 5 if we can.
Yeah, but you will have to feed it in externally here. It's not jumpable to 5.
But other than that, there are a lot of them available. That, like the things that'll attach to the top of your car generally will do 3 volts.
And again, we're looking for the dual band ones, which is a much more limited class of antennas.
Yeah, you do need to be able to power those, but most people will be using just a single band antenna, I expect.
Well, I would not expect that if they're going to buy the expensive module here, because they're going to be...
No, if they buy the expensive module, yes. Yeah. But I'm saying that most people won't buy the expensive module, probably.
Okay. Anyway, we do have a provision for that, so...
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
You said it's pretty crammed in there. What about heat buildup, Scotty? Have you figured that out?
Well, the heat generating devices are typically the U4 here. Let me go back to the, it's going to be this guy here and to some extent the GPSs. And the GPSs are rather large. And what I was just talking to John about, what we're going to try to do here, this oscillator is a TCXO, and it's supposedly highly temperature compensated, but of course, the less temperature variation you can put it through, the better off you are. So we're talking about actually isolating the ground connections, the thermal ground connections underneath it to prevent conduction. And it's far away from U4. This is going to be the big heat generator. And we're I don't know where the heat source is going to be on this module because you can't really get a spec on what the current consumption is because it varies depending on whether it's booting or whether it's what it's doing because it's got a processor in it. So I don't know where the heat generating parts are inside here because this is a hybrid. So it's got a can over it. So the heat might come out down here or up here, or it might spread out evenly but this is about as far as we can get it away. So what the idea is in an emergency where if we determine that this is not going to work because the GPS produces too much heat and we have to get the oscillator away from it, what we do is we plug the oscillator into this jack and we move it off the board if we have to. But that's really mechanically messy because you have to have a place to mount the board then, and you have to have a place where you can run a cable to it. What you do is you buy these cables are not that easy to make. I don't know how I would make one myself. I would buy one with the connectors on it. So you buy a jumper, and then we'd have to build a small board that contains the TCXO and mount it somewhere else.
Got it. This board is not laid out. It's not planned to be operated vertically, but rather horizontally. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. So there will be no heat flowing upwards from U1 and U4 onto Y1. In fact, the heat would flow upwards or out of the page from U1 and U4, therefore drawing ambient air into the crystal and then over towards U1. So in fact, they may not heat it too much.
It'll also be flowing through the planes. Planes are heat sink.
Right.
And it's also sandwiched between heat sources, is it not?
That's what we're going to try to eliminate or minimize is the heat flow from the plane up into the oscillator. This oscillator actually consists of if you can kind of see it here, it's a crystal oscillator with components on it, and it's mounted on a piece of FR4. So it's already double layer. And then we're going to isolate the internal ground plane of the board around this oscillator and make a single thermal, yeah, basically a thermal to it to prevent conduction into the oscillator itself.
You're not actually going to limit the ultimate temperature excursion. You'll just limit it how quickly it changes.
Right. And the other thing is if we can get any airflow at all across this board, it will definitely make the temperature be lower because it doesn't take much air to lower temperature if you don't have a lot of actual heat being produced. I know we had the Cyclone 5 board that we did for SDR on the IQ2. It would get noticeably too hot for your finger to place on it when the thing was operating. But we put a stick-on heatsink on the top of it, and we had a 3 CFM fan. I mean, you're talking about a guy like 20 centimeters, 20 millimeters across, very not even an inch across. And it was so quiet, you could barely hear it. You could, if you put it up against your cheek, you could feel it, but you couldn't feel it with your fingers. And it was amazing. It was enough to drop the temperature radically because it would accumulate the heat and get hot, but it didn't really create a lot of heat flow. It didn't require a lot of heat flow to cool it down. So I guess we're going to find out. And I'm guessing that when you put this whole thing in an enclosure, you're going to need some kind of fan. I don't think there's any way around it because you're just going to have to. So, and it may be that we use an extension of the leaf connector to supply the fan. We actually do have a fan connector on the tangerine board, but we have to mount it somewhere. And I'm thinking we're going to aim the fan over the FPGA downward and let it flow out like this. So you're going to get flow. By the way, the FPGA in this board is right over here, but not underneath the clock module, but adjacent to it. So you're going to want to keep that heat away from this clock oscillator too. So you're going to want some air blowing away from things. So it'll be dependent on where we put the fan. And of course, when you stack boards up, then you block the airflow. So this is actually a better solution, I think, than what we originally had, because it was going to end up being partially over the FPGA. So not as good.
Yeah, the difficulty, of course, is in some situations, you want maximum airflow, and in others, you want it sealed up tight so it doesn't freeze. So it's hard to know the actual thermal application.
Yeah. And so this really, none of the parts on this board are really that power hungry. Even the Max 10, it's not, when you get the Cyclone 5 CVA 9 with 300,000 logic elements, then you're talking about heat that you got to get out of there. But with only 50K LEs, it's not as big of a deal. In fact, the A to Ds on the RF module will dissipate more power than the FPGA is likely the case. And they're, of course, on the backside facing outward. So we'll be able to cool those, perhaps. We haven't really thought about the overall cooling. And
A to Ds do get hot. Flex Radio had the problem. They use a stick on heat sink on their A to Ds.
Yeah.
It got so hot it melted the adhesives and the heat sinks fell off down into the electronics, and that generated a product recall for them. So you got to watch out for that.
I heard about that.
Happened to mine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Happened to another friend of mine's too. So if you use the stick on heat sinks and you get the proper adhesive and you keep the temperature down, it really doesn't take a lot of airflow to keep the temperature down, but it does take some. So we have to figure out a way to channel the air. And I know on the IQ2, we fit the boards so that in the chassis, the boards were uptight against three sides and there was a gap against the fourth side. And then we blew the air downward, which I know is counterintuitive. You really want to blow it outward. But what I wanted was outside air blowing right on the hottest part. So it blew inward on the heatsink of the FPGA, and then it flows along the receiver board with the hot ADC, which also has a heatsink on it, and then it flows down through the slot to cool the bottom, which is the transmitter board, which really doesn't have very much heat generating capability, and then it flows out the bottom. So it kind of flows. We kind of channeled the air because we only had 3 CFM, so we really didn't need very big channels. And all we needed was just a little teeny bit of air, and that was enough. And it is amazing too, because if you didn't put that fan on there, you put it in the case, 10 minutes it overheats, doesn't run. It actually will throttle back and not perform properly. So a good lesson to learn. So we're getting closer. And I'll tell you, the CAD guy's first answer, originally, see this notch here? This notch is for the leaf module, which is, they'll be like this. If you can see my hands. The leaf module will be in the upper right, clock module will be in the lower left. And originally this board was to the left of this hole was where the board edge was. And the CAD guy emphatically just said, it's not going to work. We can't do it. You can't put both GPSs on there. And so I kind of cajoled him to put some of them on there, put the two big parts on there. And then there was just this whole boatload of parts sitting off the board that there was no place to put. There's no space for them. And so we ended up extending this as far to the north as we could, because right up here is the USB 2 connector on the data engine. And below here is the RF connector that goes to one of the RF modules. And this is the left side of the data engine board along here. So all of the connectors come off that side. The leaf module is this cutout here. And then the FPGA is the big guy right along here. And I told him you can't put this board over the FPGA because you can't block the airflow to it. So you can see so what we did is I gave him that outline and he said, it's still impossible. So we went in and we just stripped out all the possible parts that we could. We changed out all the SMT headers, jumpers, because the SMT jumpers come down like this. And so they're much wider on the layout. So we made them through hole to save space. We made them all 2 millimeters instead of 10th inch center jumpers. We went through, and I don't know if you can see, let me go back here. this part right here, I don't know if you can see that down by the lower SMA. That's a 6-pin gate that is a Schmidt trigger. So this is equivalent to a SOT 23 type part that has a single gate in it. Well, we put an SO14 on there to start with the 6 gates in it. And the SO14 is like the size of both of these parts together. And so he says there's no way it's going to fit. So I went back to the data sheets and I picked the smallest package I could find. And so you know what's going to happen now. The CAD guy will lay it out, and then my manufacturer is going to be just giving me what for picking such small parts that he's going to have trouble laying them out. But these are 6-pin parts, and they're incredibly small. This is only millimeter by 1.5 millimeters, the size of this part. This is an 0402 part right next to it, and this is a 6-pin, it's an IC gate. And yeah, show a little perspective, these parts here are the 47 microfarad capacitors. These are like 1210s, okay, which is normally, that would be considered a big part that you could solder by hand. And you can see how many of them I have, and they're scattered all over the board. I even had to put one out here in between the connectors. So he did a pretty good job, I think. Now, when we get to laying it out, we'll really see what compromises we actually made that we don't like, because you're going to see bypass capacitors too far away from their pins, and you're going to see, you know, traces that are extended out far away. But you got to keep it in perspective that these SMAs are 1/2 inch apart from center pin to center pin. They're 1/2 inch, that distance. So when you say, oh my God, look, the trace runs from there over to there, I mean, it's only 1/4 inch. So it's really, you got to get it into perspective, because when the board's only 1.8 inches square, there's not really any place that's very far away. But that said, the differential pairs still have to be routed next to each other, and they have to be routed the same length because they're all clocks. So they got to be the overall the same length in each pair. So this is why he earns the big bucks and I let him do it, because it's hard. And he's been doing it for, let's see, since about 1988 or 89. So like, over 30 years of layout. This guy is the best layout guy I've ever worked with. So if he can't do it, then you might as well give up.
New country. You know, it seems like there's no chance of anybody ever actually working on this to modify it or repair it.
Little chance. What we've tried to do, there's a couple pins that are variable, and we've tried to make it so that you can adjust them or change the state of them by pulling a part off. Because I found it's much easier to pull an 0402 part off, which usually means it gets stuck to the iron, it burns up, it flies across the room. You take one off and move it, almost impossible. But I could take one off, okay. I could take it off with a pair of dikes, just cut it in half. So if we can make the mod something easy to do just by removing a part, then we did that. So for instance, on the jitter reducer, there are low-pass filter pins that are digitally selectable. So originally we had four resistors, 2 pull up and 2 pull down. So because we don't know what the filter is we want to select yet. So we're going to figure this out, and then we're going to put the resistors on in production that match the filter that we want. But in the meantime, when we're trying to debug this, we got to change 0402 resistors. So I put jumpers on there. Well, the CAD guy says no jumpers, they're too big. You got to get rid of those. So what I did is I put pull ups on the pins and then pull down 0 ohm pull downs. So now they are both low, and whichever one or both you want high, you just snap out that resistor, that 0 ohm resistor, and then it goes high. So you can do it even without a soldering iron if you're careful.
Scotty, are there any unused outputs on the FPGA that you could use for configuring that?
No, I'm way short of IO.
Yeah, because the traces are smaller than resistors and,
Well, we have a lot of things are configurable in the FPGA, or in the GPS and in the synthesizer that are configurable, and they're configured by the I2C port from the FPGA. We have both an I2C port and a UART port going to all these parts on the board. But the low-pass filters we figured are most likely something that you're not going to change, not if you keep the clock frequency that we have, and not if you use it the way we're going to offer it. But we want to be able to change it if you really want to. We're going to make you really want to change it. It's like the how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Well, only one, but the light bulb's got to want to change.
Well, I've changed out 0402s, so oh well.
Yeah, and the other problem is it's going to be really packed, as you can see. It's not going to be easy to get in there. These are tall also, and these are not. So it's, but I just, there's not really anything I can do about it because this is what fits. This is the size that we have to work with. And so we tried to make it as flexible as possible and give you the as many options as possible without using your soldering iron. But there's just going to be some assembly required if you want to do exotic things. Like if you want to, if we can get this connector changed, so it's got a switch in it, that'll eliminate that. But the low-pass filter, you're going to have to solder to change that. And thinking, there are a couple of things that we put 2-millimeter jumpers down here. There's the GPSs have external interrupt inputs so that you can actually get the GPS to timestamp inputs, these hardware inputs that we routed down here. But John says he's tested it on the evaluation board. And he says it kind of works, but it doesn't really work very well. So he's not really excited about anybody bothering with those inputs, but we put them there anyway. And let's see, what else do you have for, we also have this 6-pin jumper here. This supplies I2C port and power, and 3 and 5 volt power and ground. So you theoretically can power the entire board off of that header for debug purposes. You don't need any M.2 connector. You can power the thing up and you can scope it out and program it over the I2C port without having anything else connected. So that was one that John wanted on there. And then we also have the GPS. The high-end GPS has a second serial port. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that's used for, but you have access to it on this 4-pin header down here in the lower right. So we've tried to go through every pin combination, every use case that people would want, and bring the pins out. And when you plug this into the header or the carrier board that John's going to design next, there's a lot of IOs here that don't go to anything on the data engine, but they go to the connector because you might want that for another feature. So the carrier board that John's going to develop is going to be able to take this card and change it into a lab grade frequency standard kind of, GPSDO for your shack. If you're not interested in the tangerine at all, but you are interested in clock, high performance clocking, then you can use this, not really standalone, but it's another use case for the board. So like I said, we've got, actually have 10 clock outputs that come down here to the M.2 connector. So you've got lots of extra IOs if you want to use this board for a different purpose. Well, the data engine only uses 4 of them. So that's kind of the overview.
Scotty, when the GPS receiver loses fix or doesn't have a good signal, it's that TXCO that keeps everything running, right?
Yes, it's the TXCO that will do the holdover, and John's going to have a whole lot to say about holdover this weekend at the HAMSAI conference.
Okay, good.
That's one of the big concerns that we have, and there's not really a good solution to that, but there's an okay solution.
Yeah. I was wondering about that too, because a lot of people, when they set up these VLF systems, they have these GPS modules, but they don't have any holdover. And I was excited that this would offer at least some sort of holdover that would be a little bit better than the holdover from the stock GPS receiver. That would be a really nice feature.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how John is planning to do that. That is something that we are planning to address, or he's planning to address. So best to listen to his talk this Friday and ask him that question.
Yeah, it's actually built into the synthesizer chip. The holdover function is inside the chip, and the TCXO runs it. The synthesizer chip's got some registers that track offsets. And so when it goes into holdover, the TCXO runs it from the last hold on the synthesizer registers. That's my understanding.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So you do get something for your money on the fancy GPS.
Looks good, Scotty.
Like Scotty says, listen to John's talk for the details.
Yeah.
I've got to drop off here, but it looks good. I'll look forward to seeing it get routed.
Okay. Thanks. I have to get off here too. So I just wanted to show this that everyone that we're making some progress here.
This is great, Scotty. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm looking forward to playing with it. It's going to be pretty impressive.
I can't wait either. This is going to be awesome.
I think it's actually going to happen. You remember, Scott, you remember when you first met me?
Yes.
Was
it DCC, wasn't it?
No, I think I actually first met you at Hamvention. I think like in maybe 2015.
No, I remember it was in the break room, the food room, and I got you confused with one of your students because I thought there's no way you could be that old to be a professor.
No, I think I met you before that, but I don't think you remember. I remember running around Hamvention one year. It might have been even before like Hamsa was actually a thing, and I was in a scout uniform running around.
Oh.
And we were just starting to like brainstorm the idea for the solar eclipse QSO party, and we were looking for replacements for the red pitayas. I think I ended up at the Tapper booth, and I think it was you that I talked to, because I think you had like the B micro, because you have the B micro, right? So I think you had those there and you were demoing them, and I was talking to you. I was like, oh, you know, it might be neat if we could make like a custom one at some point someday.
Yeah, look where we are now.
And now here we are. But that was just like, I mean, back then it was, I had nothing back then, but now here we actually are doing this. So
it's going to be good. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. Very, very excited. Thank you.
Okay. I have to run. So 7-3s, everyone. It was
7-3.
Yep.
Take care. Good meeting.
Yes.
Thank you.
7-3.
I need to go as well. So 73.
See everyone either Thursday or Friday.
73.
Great.
Okay, guys. 7-3. See you then.
7-3.
7-3.